Hello and welcome to the Journeyman Podcast. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
Join us as we travel from club to club, delving into the stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football clubs all over the world.
We'll look at club history from all angles, whether it be the team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
From our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes a platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks.
We'll take you through fascinating untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations, and everything in between.
Welcome back to episode 5, part 2, diving into Ipswich Town, better known as the Tractor Boys, the Blues, or simply Town. In part 1, we dived into their legacy, how they became into being as a football club, and delved deep into two legendary managers in Alf Ramsey and Sir Bobby Robson. So make sure to check out that if this is the first episode you've stumbled upon. Welcome if it is your first, and we've got a great catalogue of other podcasts to dive into if this is your first time listening.
And definitely go back because you can hear all about the Texaco Cup. You shouldn't miss it. But yeah, we've got lots more Bobby Robson magic to get into. And I feel like we've been spoiled last couple of episodes with you with Porto, last time out with Ipswich, and like you said, the amazing stuff with Alf Ramsey. And let's get into it and pick up where we left off last time.
Derek Nippard has got two watches out there. They say time, and Ipswich win the cup for the first time in their history. A moment to treasure for Bobby Robson and the East Anglian fans, and they thoroughly deserve it.
So our ending point from part one was diving into their first ever big run in the UEFA Cup under Sir Bobby Robson. And this time we dive back into their next run in the UEFA Cup. So we're diving into the 1974-75 season. And again, Ipswich will be back in the UEFA Cup, back on the continent. And once again, they were drawn against a familiar opposition that they played last time out in FC Twente.
And the Dutch team proved to be more of a formidable opponent than last year and drew 2-2 at Portman Road. Johan Zudema had put the away team ahead before two quickfire goals just 4 minutes apart from Brian Hamilton and Brian Talbot to put the Blues back ahead. But Theo Palplats would make it 2-2 in the 83rd minute to make sure the Dutch side had a considerable advantage with their two away goals going into the second leg.
You have to give some credit to FC Twente here because they are the first European opponent to even lay a glove, really, on Ipswich Town at Portman Road. Real Madrid hadn't done it, AC Milan hadn't done it. So well done to the Dutch team for coming to Portman Road and getting two goals, getting a good point away from home.
Yeah, I think you've got to remember as well, this is long before Steve McLaren at FC Twente and his incredible accent. So yeah, fair play to them. So back in the second leg in the Netherlands, a strike from Hamilton was all Ipswich had come up with. So with a 1-1 draw, which saw the UEFA Cup campaign end very early, which is a shame. However, Bobby Robson would trade in the European adventure for a hell of a domestic one, as they'd carry on to finish the season in third place and just 2 points off the top spot. And they're also the losing semi-finalists in the FA Cup, losing to the eventual winners West Ham in a replay after an initial 0-0 result. And during this season, Derby County won the top division for the second time in their history with 53 points, while Liverpool just edged out Ipswich to second place thanks to their better goal average. A little shout out to our first episode to go back through goal average again. Liverpool just edging out Ipswich there for second place.
So after impressing on the continent, he's putting it together at home in the UK. Ipswich that season would do the double over the eventual champions Derby, winning home and away, but then they would lose home and away to relegated Luton Town, losing to 16th place finishing Arsenal and 17th place finishing Birmingham. Seems to paint the kind of picture of this struggle against lower league teams, which ended up with them not winning top division of England at the time.
So they came so close, going into the 75-76 season, that third place from last year still earned them a spot in Europe for the third consecutive year. So Ipswich becoming more and more of a part of the furniture in Europe once you get to your third consecutive season there. And the UEFA Cup beckoned once again, and of course Ipswich ended up with Dutch opposition again, this time with Feyenoord. And Feyenoord actually won the UEFA Cup the year before when Ipswich had their miraculous run to the quarters. But yeah, with Feyenoord beating Spurs in the final. But this was 2 years on, and could the Blues go on another incredible journey?
In their first match, they'd go to the De Kuip in Rotterdam and win 2-1, putting Ipswich in the driving seat for the tie. Two more unreplied goals at home would make it a commanding 4-1 win on aggregate over the two legs. And next up in the second round would be Club Brugge. Can you guess, Mark, who would be managing the Belgian team at this point, Mark?
I mean, I'm guessing it's someone related to a previous episode.
I mean, you would have thought that if I put it in the script, but it was our old friend from episode 2 of Hamburger SV, Ernst Happel, the absolute legend from HSV there.
What a guy. He's coming back, another nice link there. And if you listen to that episode, you know how positive we spoke about his team and the way he'd set them up. But yeah, the Tractor Boys didn't care, and they took a commanding 3-0 lead in the home leg.
Goals from Gates, Pedelty and Austin must have had the fans dream of the next step of Europe. But when Ipswich walked out into the newly opened Jan Breydel Stadium, They came under siege from the first minute, conceding five corners in just the first 12 minutes.
Lambert would make up for his lack of goals at Portman Road by getting the first one from the penalty spot here at the 11th minute. And then Daniel de Cuba would make it two just 50 minutes later. And this is all before half-time. Ulrich Lefebvre would wipe out the aggregate lead completely and making it 3-0 on the night to the Belgians. And with this home crowd, create this daunting atmosphere. And just like that, Ipswich's 3-0 lead is gone.
Ipswich would get back into the game, regain their composure after the half-time break, and look more defensively solid. For the majority of the second half, they must have been doing all they could, running on pure adrenaline to keep out the Belgians. And it took all the way up until the 87th minute, when a Lefebvre cross found René van der Drechelen in the box to score. He made no mistake, grabbing a crucial fourth goal for Club Brugge and completing a historic comeback, one of the best in UEFA Cup history at that time.
Heartbreak for the Blues. Throughout these this selection of European games that we've picked up on so far, you can see Portman Road becoming a fortress where they can put together these great performances. But then when they travel away, I think the lack of European experience really sort of comes through. Although, to be fair to him, Ernst Happel's Club Brugge team would go all the way to the final in that year's UEFA Cup, so they were very much worthy competitors.
They're really making a habit of being beaten by like eventual finalists or winners, to be fair to Ipswich Town. So they're really taking on the big dogs of Europe at the time.
And I think one thing we should remember is like there's still such a little European experience, not even just in this current squad they have, but just in general. Like the club wasn't even playing in these top divisions up until a few years before, so it's pretty amazing.
Despite the relative success in Europe, Ipswich would fall back down to sixth place in the league and thus miss out on Europe for the fourth time in a row. But to be fair, three times on the bounce is an incredible achievement. Bobby Robson, simply talking about this team, said, in 75, I had a very good team, keeping it short and sweet there, in compliments to his team.
Moving into the next season, more time spent on the training ground. The 76-77 league campaign would see Ipswich climb back up the table to finish third, just 5 points behind eventual winners Liverpool and 4 points behind second place Man City. And you can see they're becoming a team who are just always in and around the top. They're not quite achieved the title in these last couple of years, but they're around there. They're in the hunt in Europe again. But once again, I think the problem is they're coming unstuck against the teams lower down in the league. So like their only two losses at home during the entire season would be 1-0 loss to Middlesbrough and a 1-0 loss to relegated Stoke City. And if you think if they'd taken those 6 points, what a different story that is. Plus they'd lose the Old Farm derby, as it's coined, to Norwich at Carrow Road 1-0, which is so painful. So if you think those small losses, if they could have had even just an extra 6 points there, they'd have won the league.
But ahead of the season, Ipswich Town would sign a big player, Paul Mariner from Plymouth, for the club record fee at that time of £220,000. His 10 league goals helped the club to this third place finish, but his name will be coming up much more throughout the rest of this pod.
The impact he made in the 6 months after joining Ipswich, he would actually make his England debut as a substitute in a 5-0 win over Luxembourg at Old Wembley. Played from the beginning in the following game against Northern Ireland in the British Home Championship at Windsor Park, Belfast. And he impressed in both games, but he's definitely someone who has a real impact on this Ipswich team over the coming seasons.
So a little spoiler here as we move into the following 77-78 season. Mariner would score 7 goals in the FA Cup as the club went all the way to win its second major honour in its complete history. Ipswich kicked off their campaign in the third round away to Cardiff City. Bobby Robson would declare this game as being the most important match the club is going to play all season.
And his players would respond to this call by winning 2-0 with a brace from Mariner. And the match would also see captain Mick Mills make his 494th appearance for Ipswich, which is a club record. He'd add a further 243 to finish on 737, which is pretty impressive, isn't it?
It would be Hartlepool at Portman Road next up, and the Blues smashed four past the Monkey Hangers to win 4-1.
And we're now in the fifth round, and Ipswich would face second division side Bristol Rovers. And this game was played on a very frozen Eastville Stadium pitch, and the lower league team came into the match against Ipswich having just lost two of their previous 14 matches. And the Blues would actually get themselves into the lead thanks to Robin Turner, but it would be the underdogs that would see themselves ahead next as Ipswich goalkeeper Paul Cooper failed to clear a corner, which was subsequently headed in by midfielder David Williams.
Then it would be Williams scoring again after a Russell Osman clearance. Ipswich avoided a late scare as Bobby Gold then scored for Rovers, but the goal was disallowed with 4 minutes to go. Mariner secured an equaliser, and that sent the game to a replay back at home at Portman Road. Thank God, going back to the fortress.
Fortress Portman Road, and knowing how good they are at home, it wouldn't be a problem, and they would win 3-0 in the replay, and that would see Ipswich into the sixth round, or what we would call now the quarterfinals. And this is where fans really got to start dreaming of Wembley, and they've got a tough test though, going away to Millwall.
The Den, which is Millwall's home stadium, would live up to its usual feral and violent atmosphere as George Burley's speculative effort found the back of the Millwall net, prompting violence in the terraces, unfortunately. The fighting would spill out onto the pitch and even forced a 17-minute delay in the match.
Yeah, and there's actually been fears of crowd violence before the game. We found it quite bizarre when we were looking at the pre-match entertainment. It actually consisted of a mock Wild West shootout, which probably wasn't the best choice of entertainment before the game. Manager Bobby Robson was actually quoted for much stronger weaponry in his post-match comments, suggesting that flamethrowers should be used to control the hooligans who are bringing the game into disrepute. But actually, once the dust had settled and he was out of the heat at the moment, he admitted that his comments were way too harsh. And he probably shouldn't have said that.
Just a little bit. The Blues would have to wait up until the early second half to double their lead, and then Mariner would convert a failed clearance to make it 3-0 with 15 minutes to go. Millwall would pull one back, but then Ipswich would really turn on the style, scoring three times in as many minutes with Walk, Talbot and Mariner, who would complete his hat-trick in the process and make the scoreline 6-1 with Ipswich progressing to the semi-finals of the AFA Cup.
I feel like going to the Den and beating Millwall 6-1 is, you know, like when you have like a wasp's nest and you're just like poking it with a stick. So I imagine that was when things got even crazier. But yeah, 6-1, and talk about a statement. They're now on the road towards a neutral ground in the semi-final of the FA Cup. West Brom would be the opponents, with Highbury being the venue. Beautiful old ground. Great venue for a semi-final of the FA Cup. And 3 years earlier, Ipswich actually reached the FA Cup semi-final but suffered heartbreak after losing at the second attempt to West Ham. So can they do it this time? Can that previous experience push them on?
And so it was, as Ipswich get off to a flyer in the semi, netting in the 8th minute from Talbot with a diving header. It was quoted that Talbot displayed outrageous bravery to score as he would be injured in the process. Talbot was forced to withdraw from the match and sustained 3 stitches as blood poured from his head and he suffered a concussion, so really suffering for Ipswich Town here. But they're off to a flyer, 1-0 up.
You know, it must be bad when, like, this is in the 70s and usually, you know, it's like, get up, you know, I don't care if you've got a broken neck, you carry on playing. So, like, it must have been pretty bad if they've told him to come off and he has to have his stitches and there's blood pouring out everywhere. But Mick Mills, the 737 appearance man, would double the lead just 12 minutes later. However, with just 13 minutes left in the game, Ipswich would concede a penalty that was smashed home by Tony Brown. In the dying embers of the game, Woods would swing in a corner that would be met by John Walk, a free header that would make it 3-1. Settle the nerves and confirm their place in the FA Cup final and send the fans into absolute delirium.
So here we are at the 1978 FA Cup final. Arsenal are the opponents against Ipswich Town. And we just have to say a little bit that in the 70s, the 80s, in England, the FA Cup final was as big as winning the likes of the Premier League or the Champions League. It was a kind of a day where the whole country came to a still and crowded around the television box to watch the two best teams in England battle it out. So for our modern listeners who maybe not think the FA Cup's a little bit of just a domestic trophy, in the 70s, in the 80s, this was the big thing that a lot of teams and players wanted to win.
Absolutely huge. Like you said, the whole country will be watching. This is the end of season showpiece, isn't it? In terms of preparation, a 6-1 league defeat by Aston Villa probably wasn't the best way to prepare for the FA Cup final, but I think this was soon forgotten about as they met up in their luxury hotel near St Albans to prepare for Wembley and take on Arsenal, the team whose ground they actually, Ipswich, won on to get to the final, await them here at Wembley, and they would go into this game as massive underdogs against 4 times winners Arsenal, who are appearing in their 9th final, whereas Ipswich were making their debut at Wembley and their FA Cup final debut as well.
Bookmakers William Hill offered odds of 9-4 on Ipswich to win and evens on an Arsenal win the day before the match. This was partially based on both teams' league form too, as Ipswich finished 18th, Arsenal ending the season in 5th place. So once again, it's either cup competition success or league success here, it seems, at Ipswich Town very much.
Probably one of the issues they had at this point is like their depth and strength in their squad compared to the bigger teams, and they're trying to compete with these teams on bigger budgets. They're trying to spread across Europe, FA Cup, league, and yeah, you can see it's usually one competition maybe they can do well in, and the others it's a bit more of a struggle.
I think you're completely right, as Bobby Robson was content with this underdog label, stating being the underdog helps ease the tension and that suits us fine. Arsenal seem to be most people's choice this time, but that doesn't worry us, at least.
Yeah, and whilst players were gearing up for the big match, cup fever hit fans back in Ipswich, and there was actually a hairdresser getting carried away offering free blue hair colouring for those who wanted to show their support. And there'd be just over 100,000 packed into Wembley, and let alone the millions watching on TV. So you'd excuse Ipswich for maybe needing a bit of time to settle the nerves, bed into the game, but it actually would be them who would make the first big chance.
20-year-old David Geddes caused Arsenal's left side loads of defensive problems, passing to Woods on the right side of the pitch, who cross was missed by Osborne, but struck well by Mariner. only for him to see it ricochet off the bar. The commentator stated, "The goal was gaping. Arsenal in the most desperate of trouble there. Split all over the place."
Good ball, Osborne. Mariner hit the bar, and the goal was gaping. Arsenal in the most desperate trouble there. Split all over the place. Woody Young being patted on the back by Alan Hudson and saying, "Calm down." The ball slotted through. Missed kick there. Mariner got it with his left foot, and Jennings was hopelessly beaten.
Geddes then saw his bouncing shot saved by Arsenal goalkeeper Pat Jennings later in the first half, but it would end goalless.
Yeah, but it wouldn't take long for the Blues to make another great chance, as Wymark would get the best of a long ball upfield, take on the Arsenal defence one-on-one, teeing up John Walk, who would crash a shot off the left-hand post.
Laid on for Walk. That is incredible! He's done it twice! He's so deadly for those positions outside the box. John Walk hit the post for the second time in the match. And remember, in the first half, Mariner hit the crossbar.
So a couple of times rattling the woodwork now. Arsenal, you're feeling when you watch the highlights are on the ropes, could you say? And later in the game, Woods and Talbot would combine to set Walk up once again. But his first time shot rebounds off the same left-hand post, despite hitting the woodwork three times in the final. Robson would look on casually, calmly as he sat there on the bench. But yeah, three times they hit the Arsenal woodwork.
The Tractor Boys continued to pile on the pressure and the Gunners would finally crack with 13 minutes left. Geddes took the ball and advanced towards the opposition penalty area and drove in a low shot at a difficult angle. Arsenal's Young stuck out a foot to defend it, and it deflected the ball to Roger Osborne, who shot past Jennings from 10 yards out and put Ipswich ahead in the FA Cup final.
Geddes. Moore taking on the defender and winning. The celebration's justified. Geddes beat the defender on the outside. Woody Young couldn't do anything else with it except to turn it back. And Osborne, this member of a family of 12 who've come in a special bus to watch the match, puts it away. Osborne, one of the young sun midfield heroes in football, one of the workmen of the game, puts his name on the Wembley score sheet, and Ipswich go in front.
1-0 at Wembley. Arsenal would try their best for an equaliser. They would press and press and press, but nothing would come before the final whistle blew.
It would be the first and only FA Cup win in their history, and what a day, what an occasion. Bobby Robson was delighted after the game. What a day for us, we deserved it. We played some decent football, didn't we? The whole team played well, everything was right for us. Arsenal manager Terry Neill was there, she would say, less positive about his team's performance. "I'm not going to say very much, I'm going to off to have a drink," which I think is fair play, isn't it? What can you say?
And I think with that Bobby Robson quote as well, you can close your eyes and think of Bobby Robson and just imagine him saying that, asking the reporter, like, "Didn't we? We did expect an answer right there and then on the Wembley turf right there." You can imagine it.
I'd love, like, you know, I'm not going to say much, I'm going to piss off to have a drink. I'd love that, you know, like if Arsenal get to the FA Cup final this season and Arteta says something like that in his post-match interview.
I think in these modern times it'd be more likely to be a cappuccino or something, yeah, wouldn't it? Not
yeah,
a drink.
True. Arteta off to go have a skinny latte.
He would go on to compliment Ipswich, noting that "we didn't play as well as we can do, but Ipswich deserve it today, no doubt about that." So, fair enough, the sour grapes passed for some nice complimentary words for Bobby Robson's team.
Yeah, and to be fair, Arsenal captain and future assistant manager Pat Rice actually apologised to fans and said Arsenal were lucky to escape with just a 1-0 defeat. It's not one of those where the manager and all the players have come out saying, you know, "we've been robbed here." Like, Ipswich clearly deserve this. Not just the rattling of the woodwork three times, but yeah, they definitely deserve to win this game.
So under the tutelage of Bobby Robson, they've been constantly probing and pushing for some form of silverware, and they finally got it in the FA Cup final here against Arsenal. But earlier in the season, they would be back in Europe, the Tractor Boys, on tour once again. And thanks to that third place finish in the previous season, as we've talked about, it's all starting to feel so like normal now for Ipswich Town to be in Europe. Both the domestic front and the European fronts coming together here.
It's still only the fifth time they've taken part in any form of European competition. And so in September 1977, they'd be drawn to face Swedish opposition Landskrona. It would finish 6-0 over the two legs. Job done, very well.
Next up in the second round, the warmer climates will be there for the Ipswich fans to enjoy this time. They'll be off to face the Spanish team Las Palmas. Ipswich will make it through, winning 4-3 on aggregate. Kudos has to be given to Las Palmas for their determination to stay in the tie for so long, but the Ipswich are through once again.
Yeah, and just when you think overcoming the test in the Canary Islands was tough, they'd be drawn against an even bigger challenge from the Iberian Peninsula, none other than a little-known team from Catalonia, Barcelona, who were at the time coached by a Dutchman, Rinus Michels, and featured the talismanic figure of Johan Cruyff in midfield. And between both of these figureheads, they'd helped to create and popularise the tactical philosophy now known as total football, which added a greater flexibility to a team's formation in which any outfield player can take over the role of any other player in the team. And regardless of the fanfare of taking on one of the biggest teams in the game, biggest names in the game, first leg at Portman Road, Ipswich Town were unplayable, and of course, once again, in Europe, Fortress Portman Road. If I was Barcelona, I would be terrified coming to Portman Road. Like, no wonder. And Ipswich were unplayable. It would only take 17 minutes for the Blues to breach the defence of Barca and get themselves ahead thanks to an Eric Gates goal.
And just when things couldn't get any better, 1-0 up against Barcelona after 17 minutes, they would double their lead on the hour mark with Weimark finishing with a fierce header. They'd make it 3 with 15 minutes to spare, Brian Talbot adding himself to the score sheet with a brilliant diving header as well. Ipswich 3, Barcelona 0 at Portman Road.
It was absolutely scintillating performance that left a lot of Barcelona fans unhappy with how little of the ball they'd had. And interesting to look back, even at this point, Barcelona fans seem very entitled, don't they? Thinking they deserve. But yeah, Ipswich absolutely outdone it. But I think they were already unhappy because they'd lost the El Clasico at home before that. And combined with the miserable weather, it meant only 24,000 fans actually turned up at the new camp. And with their backs against the wall, Johan Cruyff would step up and be counted.
The talismanic Dutchman would take the game by the scruff of the neck and score just 20 minutes in to get Barca back into the fight. Just 2 minutes after halftime, he would get another, and the momentum, you could tell, was starting to swing for the home team now. Just when it seemed that Ipswich could potentially escape, a penalty was awarded to the home team in the 87th minute. Carlos Rorschach would make no mistake from the spot, and it would take the game to extra time. What a comeback from the Catalan club, to be fair. It would rumble all the way to penalties, and this is where Ipswich cracked under the pressure, unfortunately.
It's gutting, isn't it? Like, if I was Ipswich, I would always be, like, desperate to be playing at home in the second leg, like, so they can always rescue it. Both Brian Talbot and Colin Villon would miss two spot kicks for the Blues, while Carles Rorschach and Juan Manuel Asensi would be perfect for Barcelona. There would be a little bit of hope as Mick Mills got Ipswich up and running, while Antonio Olmo missed for Barcelona, but Clive Woods would then miss, while Alfredo Amarillo wouldn't make that mistake and win it for Barcelona. But yeah, it's another one of those where you just think, like, what if? If they could have got through there, they're so, so good at home, absolutely, like, unplayable at home. But yeah, things keep coming awry on the away trips, which is a shame.
So despite the slump in the domestic league campaign, it proved to be a very successful season for the Tractor Boys. Bobby had masterminded another route back to the Continental football by winning the FA Cup. In the following 78-79 season, they'll be taking part in their first ever European Cup Winners' Cup campaign.
Yeah, and they debut in the competition with a 2-0 aggregate win over Dutch opposition. They love getting Dutch opposition in Europe, don't they, around this era. This time, as I said, Alkmaar. In an unfamiliar turn of events, they'd actually draw 0-0 at home in the first tie, which is very unlike, it feels like we're breaking the matrix at this point. But would actually win 2-0 away from home thanks to goals from John Walk and John Mariner. Cast aside Wacker Innsbruck 2-1 in the second round and were rewarded with a chance to get revenge over Barcelona in the quarterfinals, the same team that dumped them out of Europe just months before.
Now missing the Dutch talisman Johan Cruyff, who had single-handedly got them back into the game against Ipswich Town, Ipswich would turn on the style and grab an early advantage in the first leg at home, winning 2-1. So once again, beating huge European opposition at home, it's just incredible. Eric Gates would net a brace, and this would initially put the Blues in a commanding position, but they would be pegged back by Esteban Vigo's away goal. This would prove to be a vital lifeline for Barca, as back at the Nou Camp, things would once again go not really to plan for Bobby's men.
Barcelona would have a headed attempt cleared off the line and away for a corner, but just when Ipswich thought they'd survived this close call, the resulting corner was swung in, and after not dealing with the initial knockdown, Barcelona defender Migueli was in the six-yard box to head home and level the tie in aggregate. Crucially, on away goals, it would stay that way for the rest of the game, and it would see Robson's boys exit Europe once again at the hands of Barcelona in a similar way to the time just a few months ago, winning that first leg and getting to the Nou Camp, and things going a bit south.
However, for a more positive spin on this Cup Winners' Cup campaign, this will be where some of the bridges were built in the friendship between Fortuna Dusseldorf and Ipswich Town, as we mentioned at the beginning of part one, as they would also lose to Barcelona in the final in an absolute cracker game that ended 4-3 after extra time. Despite exiting European competition once again, Ipswich's league form would rebound with a respectable 6th place finish, and that would qualify the Tractor Boys for the UEFA Cup once again.
Like we say, this sustained time in Europe, gaining more experience. You think this is just adding to this squad's experience, Bobby Robson's experience in Europe, making them more of a well-rounded squad and coming back each time with a point to prove. And over the next two seasons, Robson would actually shore up his team with two Dutchmen, Arnold Muren and Frans Thiessen, to the club. And they'd achieve a further two top six finishes in the first division. However, it's the 1980-81 season, which, in Robson's words himself, helped put Ipswich on the map. All of this European experience, everything, this perfect mixture, bringing in a couple more players, everything comes together. And the 1980-81 season is pretty mega.
It feels like Ipswich have been coming across Dutch opposition so much that they've just gone and, okay, we'll go and get two of our own Dutchmen. Maybe that'll shake them off or something.
It'll shake the curse.
They've been so impressed by the Dutch opposition they've played again and again and again that they were like, finally, okay, we'll just take their two players or something.
I mean, even when they wasn't drawing Dutch opposition, they were playing Barcelona, which was basically like the Dutch national team at that point.
So we start on the domestic campaign of this 1980-81 season. Ipswich would start with a 1-0 victory away at newly promoted Leicester City and go completely unbeaten up until November, when their run would end in their 15th match against bottom-placed Brighton and Hove Albion, losing 1-0.
Ipswich were actually without first-team regulars Paul Cooper, Thiessen, Alan Brazil, Kevin Beattie through injury throughout this period, so to keep that in mind. And Robson remarked, "I must admit, our resources were being stretched to the absolute limit." The defeat was followed by two wins against Leicester City and Nottingham Forest. But like I said, the squad is starting to show some cracks here after that great run. But the new year would start with two home victories, a 2-0 win against Forest, and on what was Robson's 12th anniversary as Ipswich manager, a 5-1 defeat of Birmingham City. So a great way to celebrate, which took Ipswich back to the top of the league for the first time since October.
At this point, it was clear to see that Ipswich were on a roll. As Stoke manager Alan Durbin commented, "I've never seen a team with such confidence in their eyes." But Aston Villa and Liverpool were also in contention for the league title by the end of March, with the Blues lead at the top being cut to a single point by Aston Villa as we get into the business end of the top division season.
Yeah, and having lost just two league games between August and February, Ipswich's form had started to dip as a result of fixture congestion, them still playing in three competitions. They're almost being hurt by their own success here and injuries and things. So Ipswich defeated Aston Villa in April, but then with defeats to West Brom and Arsenal and Norwich would give the Midland side the initiative as they finished the month 4 points clear of Bobby Robson's men with a game in hand.
Ipswich would need to win the last two games of the season to keep themselves in the fight for the top spot. They led 1-0 at half-time against Middlesbrough, but two goals from Yugoslavian international striker Bozo Jankovic condemned Ipswich to their sixth defeat in 9 games. They went on to lose the final game of the season 2 against Southampton, and it ended the season in second place, 4 points behind Aston Villa and 3 points ahead of Arsenal.
So close again, and they're always in that sort of title hunt in the European spots, so close, but the season wouldn't be in vain. So despite once again falling short in that league battle, Robson's men would keep going on the continent. Their first round fixture was actually against the Greek side Aris Thessaloniki. It would be a very bad-tempered affair, which would see Aris's Georgios Foros sent off after a second yellow card, plus Ipswich were awarded 3 penalties, all of which were converted by John Walk. He'd also grab a 4th from open play, and Paul Mariner, of course, had to go and get one for himself. Aris grabbed themselves a consolation goal from the spot, but it would finish 5-1 to the Blues.
For the record as well, that 2 yellow cards sending off happened before half-time as well. In typical Bobby Robson style, the away leg would prove to be a tougher affair than the demolition at Portman Road. Terry Butcher speaks retrospectively about the tie, stating, "We had no prep at all to go by concerning the opposition. We didn't have a clue who they were or how they played. All we knew that they were from Greece."
This is long before like detailed scout reports and things like that. "Yeah, what were you doing next game, boy? Well, we've got these Greek lads." "Right." "Anything else?" "Oh, I don't know, they like gyros or something."
It's very different now, where like even a wonder kid props up in like the third tier of Germany, everyone and their dog will know about him within like a couple of weeks. So yeah, this is a very different era we're talking about here.
But this is one thing that always fascinates me, is like, do you know now if there's, I don't know, a breakout star striker in the Serbian league, for example, within a season he's going to be signed by Juventus or some, I don't know, he's coming to one of the top leagues. But back in this sort of era, I think we did it a couple of episodes ago as well, is where like you'll get a player, I don't know, he'll just play his entire life for like Dynamo Moscow. And like he could be genuinely like, but like because TV scout it, like it's not the same, social media, like players will just play their entire lives in their home country. It's like quite an interesting thought of how, like, you know, what would it have been like if Theodoros Palace from Aris came to the UK? Like, who knows?
Terry Butcher would continue on in this laid-back tone, talk about the game, saying, "We were confident after our 5-1 win at home, and it was almost like a break or a holiday for us, that trip to Greece. John Work's mother-in-law was living in Greece at the time, so the plan was to stay over for a meal after the game. We went on this little trip the day before the match, or perhaps it was even the morning of the match, so we could enjoy the scenery." And yeah, so it sounds like they were having a lovely time.
But yeah, I think the match was anything but a holiday. It was actually be 2-0 down within 22 minutes, making it 5-3 on aggregate. And things would continue to unravel as the Greek side netted a third just after the hour mark to really get the Blues fans biting their nails. But in the 75th minute, Eric Gates popped up to get Ipswich the much-needed goal to settle the nerves, and that's how it ended. So it actually ended 6-4 on aggregate with a little scare while they were on holiday.
And this aggressive, bad-tempered affair would spill out after the game as well, as the Greek team's fans would be stoning Ipswich's team coach as they left the ground. Terry Butcher continues to explain that they were lying on the floor of the bus as there was smashed glass all around us. Some of the fans were waiting on the bridge over the road to hurl stones at us. All hell broke loose. That night was quite an experience, and they tried every which way to unsettle us and pulled out all the tricks to try gain some experience against, well, Ipswich Town now, who are becoming European regulars.
Just about surviving the atmosphere there in Greece. Next up was a trip to Czechoslovakia facing Bohemians Prague, which featured the 1980 Czechoslovak Footballer of the Year, Antonín Panenka, who of course is a name that should be very familiar with everybody, with the penalty style named after him after what he did during Euro 1976. In the final against West Germany, he scored the penalty with this soft little chip through the middle of the goal as the goalkeeper dived away. And yeah, many people have attempted it since and either looked very cool, i.e. like Perla, or looked a bit of an idiot.
The first leg at home would be a dominant affair as Ipswich ran out 3-0 winners. Walk on target twice, who was substituted off with a tendon injury to be replaced by Kevin Beattie, who scored the third for Ipswich with a free kick. This would prove to be a vital goal from the set piece as the team from Prague almost put together an inspired comeback against the Blues, as they were missing regular goalkeeper Paul Cooper, midfielder Thiessen and striker Mariner all through injury, as well as John Walk before. Tibor Michinek saw the home team lead after just 2 minutes, and then Panenka scored a free kick, which kind of feels a bit weird. Panenka scored a free kick. Anyway, Panenka scored a free kick to make it 2-0 in the 52nd minute, but Ipswich hung on for dear life and progressed 3-2 on aggregate.
Yeah, and it'd be Polish side Widzew Łódź, who would be their third round opponents, who had already actually knocked out Manchester United and Juventus in the previous round to meet Ipswich Town. So on first glance, maybe when you see the name, you're like, all right, okay. But then when you see they've knocked out Man United and Juventus, they clearly should be taken very seriously at this point. And however, at Portman Road, like many teams before them, the Polish side crumbled, conceded 5 goals, with Walk grabbing another hat-trick, while Alan Brazil and Mariner got in on the act too. Back in Poland, on a frozen pitch, things would go a little bit smoother for Bobby's boys, as they only conceded a sole Marek Pieta goal that would see the tie end 5-1 on aggregate, and Ipswich in the pot for the following round. So even despite smashing them at home final, it's still this Bobby Robson, Ipswich in Europe away, a second leg curse, isn't it? They still lose 1-0. But never mind, 5-1, they don't care. And after a 3-month break, it seemed like their away struggles would continue when they lined up against St Etienne in front of 43,000 people. The French side had dismantled Hamburg in the previous round, and in their ranks had Johnny Rep, Patrick Batiston, and a certain Michel Platini.
When Johnny Rep scored after 60 minutes, it looked as if it would be a familiar script of an away game would play out for the Blues. 12 minutes later, however, Mariner connected with a Mullerin cross to make it 1-1. And in the second half, with the home team pushing forward, Ipswich delivered a stealthy counter-attack, finding the net 3 times through Mullerin, Mariner and Walk, blowing away this away day curse in Europe.
This was arguably the greatest match Ipswich had played under Robson, who'd dubbed it tremendous, almost faultless performance. "We've demolished a good side with one of the best victories anyone has achieved in Europe in the past 10 years. And imagine hearing your manager say that, like, even after your performance, you hear your manager say that, you're just even more
up for it, aren't you?
2 weeks later, Ipswich would score three times in the second half at Portman Road, winning the tie 7-2 on aggregate, with goals from Terry Butcher, Mariner, another penalty from Walk, and this result ensured that Ipswich progressed to their first ever European semi-final. So this club, who go back to when like Alf Ramsey got the job, and he's saying, you know, this club, they don't really have a huge football pedigree history at the time, they're now in a European semi-final. Incredible stuff.
Next up in this historic moment for Ipswich would be FC Köln, for who knocked out Barcelona on the way to the stage. Walk would score in the home leg, his 12th goal of the European campaign, in a slim 1-0 win for the Tractor Boys.
Russell Osman marking again so tight in that penalty area, gates off his knee, a rare lapse of control, but he does well to get it wide for Mills. And there's Walk! The man with a magic touch is there again. John Walk comes from nowhere after Gates did superbly to get that to Mills. Then he picks out his man. No marking there, and the goalkeeper had no chance.
And in the 14 days between the two legs, this would be where Ipswich would exit the FA Cup and see their chance at winning the league title go up in smoke with losses to Middlesbrough and Southampton in the final two matches of the season. But this would only ramp up the pressure on the return leg in Germany. And with a slender lead from the first leg, you wouldn't blame the Ipswich fans for being a bit nervous, especially after what had happened in the past couple of weeks. But they made their way to Western Germany in numbers and packed out their way in what was going to be a very historic fixture for the club, regardless of how it plays out, whether they're going through or whether they lose it. Like, this is a huge, huge occasion and experience.
The Mungersdorfer Stadion, as it was named then, was completely filled to its 55,000 person capacity. However, what played out was hardly a showstopper, as with a mixture of nervousness and good defensive solidarity from both teams, it would keep the game cagey and tight. Half chances and pot shots from range were the majority of what was created by both sides in the first half, but FC Köln did have three decent kind of headed chances, with Bernd Kullmann, Stefan Engels and Dieter Müller all missing the target. However, Ipswich knew if they could just hold this defensive shape for the next 45 minutes, they would be in the UEFA Cup final.
And they've taken that very quickly. Here's Botteron. Kullmann's arriving. Well, three chances now for Cologne with headers, and they've all been missed. First Müller, then Engels, and on that occasion, big Bernd Kullmann. And that brought the first half to an end, and Cologne, for their part, will look back on those three missed chances.
Bobby Robson's men would continue to hold and keep the West German side at bay into the second half with two strong banks of four that were very well organised, shuffling from side to side, closing down the space, making it as hard as possible for Cologne to play through them. Bobby Robson could be seen on the touchline motioning a block shape with his hand, literally drawing the bus in the air with his hand while in conversation with his number two, Bobby Ferguson. Cologne continued to knock on the door, coming close as a fourth-headed chance hit the woodwork from Stefan Engels. Just before the hour mark, in one of Ipswich's few attacking ventures, they were awarded a free kick 35 yards out from goal.
It would be a lofted ball into the box, and Terry Butcher would find a pocket of space to nod the ball into the far corner of the goal and clinch the tie for the Blues. Bobby's smiling grin could be seen on the bench as the players celebrated a brilliant smash-and-grab winner. Bobby, speaking after the match, stated it was a great defensive display. We always knew they, meaning Köln, were going to push numbers forward, and that would leave two at the back that would suit Brazil and Mariner, because the ball into space was always on, and that's what worked on the break.
Taken by Mills. Oh, and the header goes in, and it's there, and Butcher came in. And Ipswich here have scored the goal that may well clinch the tie, and Terry Butcher got forward there, and Cologne were left like statues. No wonder they look so pleased on the bench. Cologne need three now.
But yeah, I think the Cologne manager is definitely going to feel like he's been FM'd there, isn't he? But moving on to the two-legged final, what a way to try and break your Dutch opposition in Europe curse by facing in the final AZ Alkmaar, who are in red-hot form, just like Ipswich there. They'd had a brilliant season and they'd won the domestic double after scoring an incredible 101 goals in the league campaign alone. And just 3 days before the first leg of this UEFA Cup final, AZ had actually wrapped up the league title with a 5-1 thumping of Feyenoord, so yeah, these guys are not messing about.
And clearly some of these Dutch players were not out of the party mood when it was time for them to come to the fortress that was Portman Road. Packed full with 27,000 people, the place was bouncing ahead of the game, keen to take advantage of some potential hangovers from the Dutch team. And Ipswich would dominate most of the match in typical Bobby Robson style at home.
AZ had no answer to Ipswich's attacking threats. They held on for just over 30 minutes before being forced into blocking a goal-bound shot on the line with a hand. So the referee awards the penalty, gives John Walk, who'd just been actually awarded the PFA's Player of the Year award, the opportunity to net his 13th goal of the tournament and got ever closer to the record at the time of 14 goals in one competition. He duly slotted home, sending the keeper the wrong way in the process and gave Ipswich a very deserved lead.
AZ held on until the second half without conceding a second goal. Just a minute into the second half, a long pass from Gates was headed down by Walk towards an on-rushing Thiessen. The Dutchman's first shot was saved, but he made no mistake to head in the rebound. 2-0, and it's feeling oh so good for the Tractor Boys right now.
Before the hour mark, they'd make it 3, with a lovely ball played down the wing on the far side of the pitch for Brazil to latch onto. Pressured by an AZ defender, he'd leave him for dead, a quick change of direction coming inside, before firing a low pass to the outside of his foot into the 6-yard box, where Paul Mariner reacted quickest to dive in at the near post. With a slight little touch, it would beat the keeper and creep in at the near post. And Ipswich would keep making chances to extend the lead as Mariner would head over, but 3-0 is how it would end at Portman Road. Yeah, you wouldn't blame Ipswich for being nervous ahead of their first ever European final, but they didn't show it at all.
We drifted the last 10 minutes where we were a bit tired, but that wasn't through us not being able to hold the pace of the game. That's through us playing 67 matches or whatever, you know. We're just a little bit weary at the end.
So what's your feeling right now, Bob?
Well, I hope we've made history for the club, and I'm proud of that, aren't I? It's been a long time, and we still have a little bit to do in Amsterdam, maybe a lot to do in Amsterdam, because it's not going to be easy. And it would be something the team have deserved, because we have been the best team in the country, and tonight has proved it, I think. That's the best of Dutch football, and we've blitzed it.
But of course, we know that the hard part now is taking the 3-goal cushion away to the Netherlands. Like, imagine what that squad felt like on the plane or whatever. It's like, oh, we've been here before. So yeah, 3-0 lead to take back. And the one thing I really don't like here, I don't like a two-legged final, but the fact that it's 14 days in between as well. Like, you know, you think of the final as like this big showpiece at a neutral ground and you pack loads of fans in there. But yeah, we've got a 2-week break. So even longer for the nerves to settle in for the Ipswich players.
A reported 7,500 Ipswich fans would make the trip from East Anglia to Amsterdam as the second leg would be played at the Olympic Stadion due to their expected higher attendance for AZ Alkmaar. And Bobby Robson would have no injury problems, thankfully, ahead of the second leg. However, there was a late scare as at the hotel, 8 Ipswich players would get stuck in a lift as they headed down to get the team coach as well to go to the stadium, so no time to escape here. But as John Motson on the commentaries stated, apart from those minor problems, the team was in good spirits.
And like you said, they were able to name an unchanged lineup for the second leg. Thiessen and Mariner responded positively to treatment during the 2-week break, so maybe this is the plus side of having a 2-week break. But also around the same time, Robson's future at Ipswich had actually been subject to debate and he'd been linked with a few other clubs, including Sunderland, who had rumoured to have offered him a then British record of £1 million over 10 years. And the great thing Robson said before the game, when he was asked about his future, he just said, well, if we lose this 3-goal lead in the second leg, I'm definitely leaving this club, you can quote me on that. So I think Bobby's even to the point where he's like, well, surely we can't do this again. Like, if we do, give me the £1 million, Sunderland.
As the teams were led out of the tunnel by the officials, you can see a whole host of blue and white balloons just drifting through the air, as well as many blue and white scarves and flags waving in the distance. And AZ would kick off with the almighty task on their hands of turning around this deficit. And Ipswich would be hoping to pull off another performance similar to the semi-final with a great defensive solidarity.
Yeah, but it was AZ's defence that lacked organisation. And just 3 minutes into the game, Ipswich would win a corner. Eric Gates would place down the beautiful Adidas Telstar ball near the corner flag, whips in across towards the front post. It's headed high into the air, looping down towards the edge of the box. And it's met on the volley with the right foot of an on-rushing Frans Thiessen. He connects with it beautifully and it flies into the back of the net, leaving the AZ goalkeeper completely planted. The Ipswich fans behind the goal are in dreamland and what a start. And going back to what you said, it's like, right, well, if we can't beat our Dutch curse, let's sign some Dutch people. And straight away, Frans Thiessen here in the final, smashing it in there. What an important goal that is.
Away by Arnt. Thiessen! Oh, what a start for Ipswich! They scored! And the Dutchman, Frans Thiessen, puts Ipswich in a tremendous position here, because AZ now have got to score 5 to win the cup. Well, the corner curled in, and watch for Frans Thiessen, number 4, on the volley. The goalkeeper never moved. 3 minutes gone. Thiessen for Ipswich.
The important away goal meant that AZ Alkmaar would now need to score 5 goals to win the cup. They would start to chip away at the Blues' lead just 3 minutes after the opener. They would equalise on the night through a well-worked Kurt Wetzel header. 1-1 now, but 4-1 on aggregate.
Despite the glorious start, the game would settle into the usual Ipswich away form as Altmar started to gain confidence and look more like the team that scored 101 goals in the league that season. Wetzel would clip the top of the crossbar not long after his first goal, and it would only take just under 20 minutes before the Blues' defence would be breached again. Wetzel will drop deep and find Jan Peters in space on the wing on the far side of the pitch. And despite the numbers which actually have back at the time, Johnny Metgod would rise highest to head home and give AZ a 2-1 lead in the second leg. So now it's 4-2 on aggregate. And this is when you're starting to think like, oh, history's repeating itself again, isn't it?
Ipswich would do their best to try work well on the break and earn themselves another corner just past the 30-minute mark. So this is all action in the first half an hour. Arnold Mulran would fire in the cross towards the near post, and this time being met by Paul Mariner, who flicked it towards the back post. John Walk instinctively was moving into the 6-yard box before doing enough to adjust and shape his body to connect well on the volley and score Ipswich a leveller away from home, once again in front of the Ipswich fans too. This goal would equal Jose Altafini's record for the most goals in a European campaign at the time, and he celebrated with the Blues fans as he ran towards their end with his fists raised above his head.
Mariner's flicking it on. Johnny Walk's in there. Johnny Walk. John Walk equals Altafini's record of 14 goals in Europe. The corner taken by Arnold Mulran. Paul Mariner up at the near post. Flicked the ball back. And as John Walk pulled away from those two defenders, he scored with a volley with vital touch but couldn't keep out. And that means now.
So now the Dutch team need to score 4 on the night again to win the UEFA Cup, and just 8 minutes later they narrow the deficit again with Pierre Tol smashing home at the near post to make it 3-2. And Ipswich would survive until half-time with their advantage in the tie, but once they return to the pitch, it would be more backs-to-the-wall stuff as Altmar tried to break them down.
You've got to imagine there's going to be some fans with calculators out trying to figure out, well, we've got this many away goals and they've scored this many, and how many did they need to get? And this, I'd have no fingernails left if I was an Ipswich fan in the stadium, put it that way.
I'd be surprised if there was any Ipswich fans that had nails at the end of this game. Like, I'd be very surprised.
Paul Cooper in the Ipswich goal would be doing his best to deny shots from distance, as well as a golden opportunity from point-blank range from the head of Wetzel once again. He'd have little hope of keeping out Josh Jonker's pile driver of a free kick in the 70th minute, making it 4-2 on the night. But as Bobby Robson watched on from the sidelines, the minutes would just melt away, as the further two goals AZ had needed would just be too much. Maybe they ran out a bit of steam after scoring 101 goals in the league. Paul grasped the ball after a weak header in the closing moments. He'd boot the ball high up the field, and the final whistle would blow. Ipswich Town had won the UEFA Cup.
Cooper's made two splendid saves. The flag is up for offside against Brazil, and Ipswich win the UEFA Cup on an aggregate of 5-4. Ipswich Town have lifted a trophy in their 66th match of the season, and 7,000 and more fans from Suffolk are able now to celebrate at the end of this dramatic season for their club.
What an achievement, mate. Absolutely incredible, and it's the results of like having your manager there for this amount of time, building each year, building, getting so close, and then to be rewarded with this, to win the UEFA Cup. And also, what an experience for the fans who made the trip there to Amsterdam to see this. Like, absolutely incredible. And if you were there, if you're listening to this now and you were there, please comment on Twitter, Facebook, whatever, tell us what was that night like, because It sounds dramatic, and watching the highlights is dramatic, but I can't imagine being a diehard Ipswich fan and being in the stands and seeing that. It's incredible.
Please tell us how you survived, because us reading it and watching the highlights, we barely survived. So bloody hell, kudos to all the Ipswich fans that travelled out to Amsterdam.
And let us know, how long did it take for your nails to regrow as well? Or even finger, like, I don't know what was left after that. Like we were saying, this UEFA Cup victory, complete vindication of Robson's leadership at Portman Road. Bobby would later state that, you know, I run the club, all concepts, all the departments. I have a hand and a say at everything at Ipswich Town Football Club. There was no money there, but he knew the strength of the club, he knew the academy, and he worked on that really, really hard.
Terry Butcher would add to this what Bobby's philosophy was. He wanted you to be the best you could be. He had this aura about him, that passion came across to all of us. The way we played football, he was building a fantastic reputation, not only in England, but in Europe as well. The UEFA Cup in 81, it was a step beyond English football. It was a step into the unknown. He made you feel good about yourself, so good about your job, you wanted to go out there and do it for him.
Yeah, and I think the most incredible stat that I read, like proof of what Robson did here, and like mixing in the youth and stuff, he only actually signed, like in his 13 years at Ipswich, he only signed 18 players, and the rest just youth players that he sort of built around. It's incredible achievement when you think of, I don't know, the money and transfers people have to do to try and compete now. And
Ipswich have punched above their weight for many years as Robson's teams finished above revered other coaches like Brian Clough and Bill Shankly, but had often failed to put together that winning silverware. So for a club of Ipswich's modest stature, this UEFA Cup victory was nothing short of an utter fairy tale.
Terry Butcher was saying, well, like when Robson first got the job, people were saying, who is this guy? But he was so ahead of his time in just every capacity.
So as the players return back to East Anglia, there will be a cup parade hosted on the 24th of May in 1981, where around 50,000 supporters were present at the Ipswich Town Hall to see their team with the trophy. And at the event, Robson announced he would remain with Ipswich for the following season, having turned down Sunderland's huge offer that we mentioned before and opting not to apply for the Manchester United manager's position.
That's another interesting what-if moment, isn't it? But moving into the next season with Robson staying on, their first task, of course, is going to be the defence of the UEFA Cup, which would start early on in September 1981 against Ferguson's Aberdeen. And the first leg ended 1-1 with Thiessen scoring for Ipswich and John Hewitt equalising. The second leg at Pittodrie saw both Gordon Strachan and John Walke score from the penalty spot before Peter Weir settled the tie with two goals. Ipswich went out of the Cup 4-2 on aggregate. And after that, their most successful campaign to date was when they made it to the third round of the 2001-2002 UEFA Cup, which we'll speak about a little bit later. After that slightly disappointing attempt at defending the UEFA Cup, a second place finish would be achieved in the league. And after that, Robson would leave Ipswich in 1982 to become the England national football team manager. And of course, we all know after that, he led the national team to the semi-finals of the 1990 FIFA World Cup. And this was the best result for England since another former Ipswich manager, Alf Ramsey, as we mentioned in part one, led the country to the World Cup victory in 1966.
So things coming full circle here for Ipswich Town and England's national team managers.
So we just need to hope that Kieran McKenna in a few years' time will lead England to World Cup victory in like 2046 or something like that.
Chairman Patrick Cobbold even offered an improved 10-year contract extension to Bobby to try and pull him from the Three Lions, but it would be too much. The manager's glorious reign at Portman Road lasted 13 years, with FA Cup and the UEFA Cup being the most cherished trophies.
And I think that's one of those that, like, if you look on pure paper and trophies, FA Cup, incredible achievements, but it doesn't do that full 13-year reign justice when you see the second place, the third places, the getting to quarters, semi-final, like, incredible glory era for this club.
Pretty much competing on all fronts throughout every season, to some degree.
You'd only have to think, like, imagine if, I don't know, there was a bit more money available, or maybe Robson wouldn't even want it, I don't know, but like if they could have maybe added a few more bodies to that squad, a bit more depth and quality, how many more trophies could he have won with Ipswich?
So we have to move past this amazing era with Sir Bobby Robson at Ipswich Town, and in an attempt to keep this successful period flowing, his right-hand man and chief coach, Bobby Ferguson, was tasked with replacing Robson in the dugout.
Yeah, and from the outside, this seems very sensible. Ferguson had been at Ipswich since 1970. He'd been a coach for 3 years. However, a combination of factors led to this position being a bit of a poison chalice, like we've seen many, many times when a very legendary manager who's hands-on at every aspect of the club leaves. How do you replace an Alex Ferguson, a Bobby Robson, a Wenger? Like, it's always going to be a tough gig, isn't it?
Firstly, Ferguson, on paper, still had the large majority of that UEFA Cup-winning squad at his disposal, despite Arnold Morwen leaving the club in the summer for Manchester United. But this talented group wouldn't prove easy to manage throughout Ferguson's spell in charge. Understandably, perhaps, as soon as Robson left, many started to see a future away from the club. Ferguson would spend his first couples of seasons dealing with transfer requests as the mess gradually started to unravel.
Secondly, prior to Bobby Robson leaving the club, they'd set in motion plans to renovate and build a new stand at Portman Road. It wasn't a universally popular decision within the club, with Bobby Ferguson in 2013 stating, "A lot of people did not want it, but at the time, Robson and enough board members did." Bobby's idea was that we'd be able to sell a player for a couple of million to help fund the project, with the cost of the redevelopment being about 1.3 million. And this led considerable financial implications on the club while, like, Bobby Ferguson is in charge. So not only has he come in after like this very successful manager, he's now got these financial restraints, so he's having to look for free transfers, he's got players handing in transfer requests, and he's got to sell people to fund the stadium. It's a bit of a tough situation.
And Ferguson, with all this pressure building, needed to hit the ground running, and sadly, this just wasn't the case. Without a win in his first seven matches, the vultures were already circling around him as Ipswich sunk to the foot of the table and were knocked out of the UEFA Cup in the first round by Roma.
The chairman would continue to back this plan on, "We're confident it will come right and we have every confidence in him." You have to remember that after 14 years with one man at the helm, a change in management is going to bring its little problems.
His loyalty will be rewarded as come March the club will be back up the table, sitting in sixth and fully involved in a race for European qualification, but a late slump would see them finish ninth. This downward momentum wouldn't be helped by stars again agitating for moves. The likes of Cooper, Gates and Brazil, all star players under Bobby Robson, would leave the club. Mills, with his contract running down, was sold to Southampton, and Brazil would go to Spurs. Thiessen would left a player's trade at the Vancouver Whitecaps, but then would move on back to England with Nottingham Forest. The 1983-84 season continued with this pattern. Despite a strong start in the league campaign, the club was rocked in October when both Walk and Mariner, their big leading strikers, requested pay increases, and with the stand needing to be built, this just wasn't possible.
Unfortunately, there's only ever going to be one result, and Mariner joined Arsenal for £150,000. And a month later, Walk sealed a dream move to Liverpool for £450,000. And understandably, like, these kind of player departures are going to have an impact on the team. And the spring of 1984 saw Ipswich literally drop like a stone, losing seven consecutive league matches in a spell that saw Ferguson's team lose 10 and 11. Steve Curry at the time stated in the Express, having to sell their best players to balance the books and pay for a new stand that they can no longer fill. So, once again, you're on that roller coaster. You've had the high and it's starting to drop down, and it's a shame.
Ipswich managed to survive by picking themselves off the canvas in a 10-match run that included just one defeat. Norwich were beaten 2-0 in the East Anglian derby. Gates scored twice in a 2-2 draw at Liverpool, and a shock win away at Manchester United would be enough to see them finish 12th away from trouble. But as this vicious circle continued to spiral out of control, it was only a matter of time before relegation beckoned. Cup runs in the 84-85 season would bring Ipswich fans some entertainment, but once more the team struggled to stay in the top flight. Terry Butcher, being the star linked away to Manchester United, caused more instability. 8 defeats in 9 during November and December with no goals scored highlighted the plight of Ipswich Town during this period. Rooted in the bottom three for the majority of the season, another escape act was needed. 3 wins on the bounce in April boosted the chances of this, and a last vital 2-0 win away at Norwich, once again beating Norwich in the Old Farm derby, and a late win at Tottenham was followed by a 2-0 victory against Leicester. Stoke City were dismantled 5-1, and they grabbed all 3 points against fellow strugglers Sunderland. This late season surge had kept Ipswich's heads above water as they finished just about in 17th place, just 1 point clear of the relegation spots. And these results had allowed them to leapfrog Norwich City, their local rivals, to being relegated instead. So, wow, what an escape act here under all this pressure of the stand and the players leaving, but they still managed to get one jab in on their local rivals. Brilliant.
That makes survival even sweeter, doesn't it? It's like you're staying up, which is great, but to then send your biggest rivals down in your place is brilliant. This comfort, though, would be not long-lasting. However, Ipswich's problems were far from over, and just a year later, it would be Norwich fans revelling in their rival's demise. The financial constraints had continued to sort of strangle the life out of the club, and you know, when you get in this situation, these escapes can't go on forever. Terry Butcher had not been prized away yet, but it would be injury kept him out the side till November, and it was hardly a coincidence that in his absence Ipswich's fortune slumped even further, and by the time he got back on the pitch, Ipswich were second from bottom.
From the end of November to early April, Ferguson's team claimed 8 wins and 5 draws in a run of 17 matches that flipped their season around completely. Wins over relegation rivals Coventry, Birmingham and West Brom helped, but it would be victories against Sheffield Wednesday, Liverpool and Nottingham Forest that gave Ipswich fans real hope. With 7 matches left in their league campaign, they surged to 16th place, giving themselves a real chance at survival.
The form would fall away right when they need it as they went goalless in 4 consecutive matches. Defeats to fellow strugglers Leicester and Villa pushed them closer to the trapdoor. They did grab a 92nd winner against Oxford United in what looked like a massive 6-pointer. But with their game in hand, Oxford themselves stunned champions Everton. So it would come down to the last day with Ipswich needing a win at Sheffield Wednesday to keep staying up in their own hands, with Coventry, and Leicester and Oxford all potentially looking to escape.
The 1-0 loss at Hillsborough put the Blues on shaky grounds, and wins for Coventry and Leicester added even more pressure to the final day. While Oxford were travelling to Arsenal, they had nothing to play for and were described as disinterested and disjointed. The U's would romp home a 3-0 win and save themselves. Meanwhile, for Ipswich, it was a painful end to 18 years in the top flight. To add salt to the wounds, Norwich had blitzed the Division 2 as champions and leapfrogged Ipswich back into the top tier. Ouch. So after their golden era under Sir Bobby Robson, things have really taken a step down. And this is where, between the 80s and the beginning of the millennium, it really starts to become a yo-yo period for town.
It's such a shame to see the club fall into that situation. And Ferguson would stay on for the first season in the second division, but would leave the club and actually became the first ever Ipswich manager to be sacked as well, which is a great stat. Probably it's not great for him, but it's a great stat. After they failed to get promotion and lost in the playoff semi-finals, and then stay in the second tier for a further five seasons, with many mid-table finishes of 8th, 8th, 9th, 14th. But in the 91-92 season, they'd finally get their act together and win the Division 2 title. And as from mid-November to April, they actually only lost three games. Getting promoted in the 91-92 season was incredible timing, because they would get themselves back into the top tier to be one of the forming members of the newly named Premier League.
However, despite the shiny new name, it would be a tough season for the Blues. A very solid first half of the season would be undercut by a poor second half. Before the new year, they only lost two games, with a lot of draws in that run, but then they would only win four games for the rest of the season. Their early points haul had done enough to keep them safe with a 16th place finish, and the following season would start with three straight wins over Oldham, Southampton and Chelsea. But it would be more nail-biting stuff for Ipswich fans, as a 1-0 loss to rivals Norwich broke that run.
An unbeaten run through November and December would be enough to see Ipswich finish 19th, 1 point clear of Sheffield United in the relegation spots. Similar to the time under Bobby Ferguson, the escapes though couldn't continue forever, and the 94-95 Premier League campaign would prove to be one too many, as Ipswich were relegated, finishing rock bottom in 22nd place, a staggering 21 points from safety. But despite this horrendous league finish, there would be some highlights during the season, as they'd beat Manchester United 3-2 at Portman Road, a 1-0 away win at Anfield. But yeah, it would be a return to the second tier, now known as the First Division.
Again, Ipswich would struggle to immediately return to the top flight, as they finished 7th in the following season, narrowly missing out on the playoffs. They would, however, feature in our old favourite of the Anglo-Italian Cup, as they beat Reggio Udance, Foggia and Salerno, as they drew with Brescia before getting knocked out in the semi-finals by Port Vale.
The continental feel of Udace, Foggia, Port Vale. So, you know, but it would be another couple of years of life back in the First Division. But by the 1999-2000 season, by this time, former player George Bailey was now in the dugout and would lead Ipswich to not one, not two, not three, but four consecutive playoff spots in Division 1. But the Blues would lose three playoff semi-finals in a row to Sheffield United, Charlton and Bolton. But incredibly, it'd be fourth time lucky for the Tractor Boys. They finished third in Division 1, just 2 points behind the automatic spots. It would be drawn against Bolton in the two-legged semi-final. To make matters worse, the side had crashed out. Bolton had actually beat them in the semi-finals the year before, so a 2-2 draw at the Reebok didn't help things. And as with the away goal rule not being there, unlike in Europe, everything's to play for. And Ipswich have home advantage, which we know tends to end well in their favour. And the game would be a thriller, full of worldies, comebacks, mistakes. As Richard Wright would drop a clanger and he couldn't quite grasp a lofted ball before Dean Holdsworth poked home just 6 minutes into the game, putting Bolton in the driver's seat.
Despite scoring a penalty to equalise, it was 2-1 at half-time, with Holdsworth scoring again. They'd fight back through Magilton to equalise before conceding a worldie from Alan Johnston. Magilton would get his hat-trick in the 90th minute, still time for Bolton to get a red card before extra time. Paul Ritchie would throw David Johnston to the ground to give Ipswich a third penalty of the game and the lead in the process, the commentator proclaiming, "Surely the hoodoo is over now." Bolton would be down to 9 men before the on-loan Dutch striker Martin Reusser confirmed Town's place in the playoff final.
If the semi-final started poorly for Ian Wright in goal, the final wasn't much better, as Barnsley's Higlett unleashed a powerful shot from distance, only to see it can off the bar, hit at the back of Richard Wright's head and go in. Tony Mowbray would equalise with a thumping header 20 minutes later, and Ipswich would turn on the style shortly into the second half, two quick fire goals just before the hour with Richard Naylor and Marcus Stewart getting the goals. Ipswich would have to endure a late onslaught after Barnsley were gifted a soft penalty, which Higlett would score once again at the death, but it would be Martin Reusser running through on the counter-attack to seal Ipswich's return to the Premier League, with George Burley jumping for joy on the touchline.
He stabbed it through. Reusser is onside. Reusser! Premiership! Done and dusted for George Burley. Nails bitten to the quick. But elevation now surely assured.
So what a great way to jump into the new millennium as we're back in the Premier League here. The 2001 campaign, and given the tendency for many newly promoted clubs to splash the cash, Ipswich would take a more conservative approach, with Herman Hreiðarsson being the biggest move to the club for £4 million.
Oh, I loved Hreiðarsson. But the fact Hreiðarsson's last two employers, Palace and Wimbledon, had both been relegated from the Premier League during the defender's time, didn't inspire huge amounts of confidence from the fans. But Ipswich's squad also contained the likes of Matty Holland, Titus Bramble and local boy Richard Wright in goal. But remarkably, it seemed that the side's steady approach to the transfer market was the right course of action.
A slow start to their Premier League campaign would only garner 4 points in their first five games. However, they would grab a 1-1 draw against Manchester United.
Yeah, and they would announce themselves to the Premier League as they won 2-1 away at Elland Road to a Leeds United team that later that season would be in a Champions League semi-final. It was then followed by a hard-fought draw against Giants Arsenal, so they're getting now picking up the points, getting some results against big clubs. The 13 games after the Arsenal result read 8 wins, 2 draws and 3 losses. Of the 57 goals Burley's men scored that season, 18 came within the first 10 minutes of kick-off. So opponents clearly struggled to match the side's enthusiasm to shine in the top flight.
By January, the side had reached the much sought after 40 points mark, which generally required to stay in the division. And in fact, against all odds, for much of the season, Burley's side were way up top five of the division, to be fair.
They've just been promoted. They're in with a shout of European football. It's very much like Alf Ramsey's season in charge, almost that first season in the top division. And it wasn't until late January they did start to show signs of slowing down with 3 consecutive losses, but that would be swiftly turned around with a 2-0 win against Everton. And they would actually win 7 of their last 11 games to finish strongly. And on the last day of the season, they're actually still in contention for a Champions League place. So it's an incredible first season back in the Premier League. But a draw with Derby would mean they'd have to settle for the UEFA Cup instead. But no promoted team had finished so highly before, as the Tractor Boys went from the playoff champions in 2000, challenging the top four in the Premier League in less than a year.
We're looking at the league table here, and we have Manchester United, who were crowned champions, Arsenal, Liverpool, Leeds United, and then in fifth place, Ipswich Town, just above. 5 points, to be fair, 5 points ahead of sixth place Chelsea as well. So really getting up there amongst the heavyweights of English football.
And it'd be no surprise that George Burley would win both the LMA Manager of the Year and Premier League Manager of the Year awards. Marcus Stewart actually would finish the second highest goal scorer in the league and the highest scoring Englishman in the league, with big calls for him to get an England call-up. So he had 19 goals, sandwiched between Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank on 23 and Thierry Henry on 17, which is a pretty good place to be, isn't it? And also ahead of the likes of Michael Owen, Sheringham, Heskey, Kevin Phillips. Yeah, it's very impressive.
With the news that Burley would finally have some money to spend in the Premier League, fans of the clubs looked forward to the 2001-2002 season. But can you guess what is coming next?
You worry for a chronic case of second season syndrome, especially when you add in European football. We've seen what that does to Burnley, Hull, Sheffield United over the last few years. It doesn't usually end well.
Sadly, their follow-up would leave a lot to be desired. George Burley had decided to spend some of his newfound cash in the summer of 2001, with players such as Finidi George, Marcus Bent and Matteo Sereni being brought in for big money.
Matteo Sereni, the goalkeeper, had actually joined for £4.5 million, which remains the highest transfer fee paid by the club. And he actually came in to replace Richard Wright, who joined Arsenal in July 2001 for £2 million.
The opening day defeat would be quickly forgotten about, with a 2-0 win over Derby County in game week 2. But this would be the last win until December. Almost in parallel with their downfall post-Bobby Robson, the club took it upon themselves to sanction a revamp of the club's north stand.
And this saw the diehard fans of the club dispersed around other sections of the stadium, meaning the once vocal 12th man at Portman Road, you know, wasn't effective, was no more. You sort of get why they're doing it, but it's a bit of a shooting yourself in the foot moment, isn't it? But by December, they'd stage a mini revival, and remarkably winning 7 out of 8 games to climb up the table. But that came to a halt with a 6-0 loss to Liverpool in their own backyard. And this sparked another very barren run, where they'd only claim another 6 points in the league all season, as they'd slide back down the table towards their finishing position of 18th and relegation back to Division 1 or the Championship as we know it now.
On one hand, you could argue that their European obligations allowed for more fatigue to set upon the players during a tough season, but on the other hand, it could be seen as a much-needed distraction from the torrid domestic campaign, plus giving the fans some away days to enjoy around Europe.
First round, they were drawn against Russian opposition Torpedo Moscow, and unlike under Bobby Robson, Portman Road wasn't the fortress it used to be, and Torpedo would take the lead. But things were already looking tough going away to the Luzhinsky Stadium. The Russian side wouldn't deal with a whip corner that allowed Finidi George to sweep home at the back post and give Ipswich the lead in the tie.
Next up was Swedish opposition Helsingborg, and again, with this tie, they'd have to do the job away from home, as a 0-0 draw at home in the first leg left everything in the balance. Helsingborg would even take the lead just 7 minutes in the second leg in front of their own fans, but a late fight back with goals from Herman Hreiðarsson and Marcus Stewart allowed Ipswich to move into the third round. Oh, it's feeling oh so deja vu here.
Yeah, and this is where it really starts to get interesting, as Ipswich would be drawn to face a European heavyweight now, Inter Milan. Yeah, and just as things had been working in the sort of opposite way as we got used to, with being, you know, bad at home and good away, things would go back to the old times under Robson, where Ipswich would put together a great performance at Portman Road as like this huge club rolls into town. I think this is on one occasion where you can sort of allow fans to have a half and half scarf, don't you think?
Despite the huge opposition, the Ipswich players would be fearless and take the game to the Italian side. It featured the likes of Clarence Seedorf, Ronaldo, Christian Vieri, Javier Zanetti, Alvaro Recoba, Francesco Toldo, and many more names. Plus, FC Porto's current manager, Sergio Conceição, in a niche little link back to our last episode in Northern Portugal, featured in this Inter Milan team.
Yeah, and I love sort of, you've just read out this incredible, illustrious list of players there, and that's it, Seedorf, Ronaldo, Vieri, Zanetti, Recoba. But, you know, it was Ipswich, the first ones to have a chance to score in. Titus Bramble, of all people, almost poked in a goal from a free kick at the far post. Inter would break against the run of play and force Sereni into some work, but throughout the game, both sides lacked any real quality in front of goal.
And it wouldn't be until the 81st minute when we would have our first goal of the tie. Kanyago for the Blues would make a run down the near side wing before trying to cut inside. He'd be crowded out of the box by two Inter Milan defenders, who could only clear towards the corner of the box where Clapham waited before lifting an inviting ball into the box.
The ball was perfectly placed onto the head of Armstrong, who rose highest to give the underdogs a deserved lead on the night. Portman Road, starved of any real reasons to celebrate that season, absolutely exploded as Armstrong ran punching the air towards the home end. Songs, chants, all this noise reverberated around as they willed the team home and to even so close to getting a second. Despite bringing in more stars, it would be Clarence Seedorf on the ball as the final whistle blew for this truly historic result in Ipswich, in a very long overdue return to these amazing European nights at Portman Road.
The near post goes to the far, for Arthur is there as well. Clapham. Determination that some of his colleagues hadn't shown in front of goal gives Ipswich down the lead.
This impressive result for Ipswich would only look even better, as at the time, Inter Milan were top of Serie A by 7 points. And as the second leg came around, it was Ipswich's time to grace the San Siro pitch.
But in familiar Bobby style, it would only take 18 minutes for Vieri to level the tie with a glancing header. Inter would continue to show their experience in class, and it was only the San Siro turf that gave way under Vieri's foot that stopped them from grabbing a second goal. But that wouldn't stop him for long. Inter Milan would get a free kick on the edge of the box. It would be laid off and smashed into a box full of bodies. It flew into Vieri's path, and we're not sure if it was a fluke or on purpose, but he'd flick the ball up and smash it home on the volley in fantastic style. It's the San Siro's turn to explode as he takes off his shirt in celebration, spins it around his head, and you can feel Ipswich's confidence and momentum just drain out in this moment. Maybe if they could get to halftime, settle themselves out, they could plan something back, but only 32 seconds after the halftime restart, Mohamed Callum would make it 3-1 in the tie.
Christian Vieri would round Sereni to complete his hat-trick, and Jonathan Pearce on the comms would sum the night up simply as, Christian Vieri has destroyed Ipswich Town in the San Siro. The Blues would save some face as Armstrong would slot home a 79th minute penalty, but it would be all over for the Tractor Boys in Europe, sadly.
Gouley over the top. Vieri through here. Can he get the hat-trick this time? Christian Vieri round the goalkeeper. Vieri hat-trick. Christian Vieri has destroyed Ipswich Town in the San Siro.
And back in the league, Ipswich were bottom of the table at Christmas. A run of 7 wins from 8 fixtures appeared to have secured the team's league status, but another decline set in. Relegation confirmed on the final day of the season with the 5-0 defeat.
This loss of income due to the relegation from the Championship contributed to the club going into financial administration, unfortunately, resulting in the sale of a number of players, including JB Clapham, Darren Ambrose, and club captain Matt Holland, and most notably Titus Bramble for $5 million to Newcastle, and Marcus Stewart to Sunderland for $3.2 million. A poor start to the domestic campaign, leaving the club 19th in the table by mid-October, resulted in George Burley being sacked after nearly 8 years as manager.
You just gotta feel pretty harsh after what he's achieved.
George Burley had galvanised the club after a bad period post-Bobby Robson, brought them all the way up to the Premier League, this new era of English football, got them into Europe, and then as quickly as it came, they'd fallen like a stone, back down into the depths of English football.
So after that unlikely European run, the Blues made a solid attempt to get back into the Premier League with a 7th place finish, just missing out on the playoffs. You wouldn't blame the Ipswich fans for being hopeful, as they went one better and climbed into the playoff spots following the 03-04 season, before losing to West Ham in the semi-finals. In the now-named Championship, they would go even better with a 3rd place finish, and once again lose to West Ham United in the semi-finals. And this is really where things start to slip for the Tractor Boys.
That would be Ipswich's highest finish all the way up to the current day. It wouldn't be until the 2015-16 season they'd come close with a 7th place finish. But that was followed up with a 16th place finish, and it's right back slumping down the English pyramid, as in the 2018-19 season they'd be relegated once again into League One. They'd finish as the bottom place team in the Championship, and even then they've not come close to getting back into the second tier, with 11th and 9th place finishes in League One.
And in 2009, after missing out on the playoffs, the manager Jim Magilton was fired, and he was replaced with former Man United player Roy Keane, which was box office from start to finish.
Ahead of the 2009-10 season, Keane started to sign some players, and a lot of them would be from his former club, Sunderland.
Bringing in goalkeeper Martin Fulop, Carlos Edwards, Grant Leadbitter, Jack Colback, David Healy, Daryl Murphy. Also bringing in Stan John, who we worked with at Sunderland on loan from Palace. So he was really getting the gang back together. Also used his Manchester United connections to bring in young winger Lee Martin for a couple of million pounds. Having a word with his former teammate Steve Bruce to get his son on board as well, Alex Bruce. Sticking with what he knew, but it didn't quite go to plan.
Ipswich started without a win in their first 14 games, making them the last team to record their first win in the whole league. Finally winning in the October against Derby County and recording their first away win of the season in November against Cardiff City. Their form gradually improved throughout the season, but Ipswich drew far too many games to come anywhere near the promotion race, and they finished the season in 15th.
Many inconsistencies in the 09-10 and 10-11 season meant that Keane's Ipswich side, they never really challenged for promotion, and as a result of poor form, ending with his side dropping as low as 21st in the Championship, Keane was dismissed as Ipswich manager in January 2011. But I think he didn't give the club promotions during that time, but what he did give the world of football during that time is the incredible press conference when a journalist's phone keeps going off, which I'm sure you've probably seen it. If you're listening to The Journey, you definitely must have seen this clip, but if not, watch it, because it's an absolute classic, isn't it?
The game's full of it.
But should it be stopped, the cheating?
Yeah, of course. Nobody wants to cheat. Whose phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
No idea. That's my phone, sorry.
Why did you turn it off? You're shitting. No, that's the second time it's gone off. Why don't you put it on silent?
No, it's not the second time.
Well, why don't you turn it off?
Well, I'll turn it off in a minute.
Are you just going to let it ring?
Well, I thought I'd let it ring out.
All right, that's good manners.
And this is where we turn to this new ownership group called Game Changer, which is led by the LA or Los Angeles-based businessman Brett Johnson. The club hierarchy was revitalised with the appointment of Michael O'Leary as chairman and Mark Ashton as chief executive. Brett M. Johnson, to give him his full title, has connections with the Arizona State Pension, that in turn also invests in American soccer teams like Phoenix Rising, who compete in the USL Championship, and FC Tucson, who compete in the USL League One. He's also a Chelsea supporter and has had Chelsea legend Didier Drogba as a co-director at Phoenix Rising. Also Frank Yallop, who made over 300 appearances for Ipswich Town between 1983 and 1996, and was also on loan at Blackpool too, little hint back to our first episode, was appointed manager of Phoenix shortly after Johnson's arrival.
The guy is seems to be very involved with football globally. Through Phoenix Rising, he has a partnership with Turkish side Galatasaray. He's also a director of the Danish First Division team, FC Helsingør, but he's mainly the public face of a group of investors. And the company aims to invest in professional sports anchored real estate development, which is why the deal was so important, because the club own Portman Road and the training ground. This is how they want to develop the revenue streams. Very changing background, new owners coming in. They'd let 20 players go and brought in another 19, all in one summer transfer window. A manager at the time, Paul Cook, had said a real rut had set in at the club. For a big club like this, the rut had to change, and we really did change it. And we saw that summer a lot of contracts were up. Conversations were had with former owner Evans and the new American owners, and we agreed a massive overhaul was needed.
Considering Ipswich Town had to work with the restrictions from the EFL regarding profits and sustainability, it was amazing to think they undertook such a swift and radical change. Town's squad would be limited to just 22 players, with a restricted wage expenditure to just 20% of the club's overall turnover. Town's squad would be limited to just 22 players with restricted wage rules as well. Regardless, they pressed on with the plans, and as said, Ashton and Cook would meet daily to sequence the process and balancing the ins and outs.
Certainly a lot of ins and outs. The former England youth internationals Rakeem Harper, Kyle Edwards joined from West Brom. Sam Morsey, a regular starter for Championship side Middlesbrough, arrived on deadline day. Joe Piggott, Wimbledon's top goal scorer, also came in. Connor Chaplin dropped down a level from high-flying Barnsley. So he said there were contracts to negotiate, each one a mini emotional saga. There was even one tongue-in-cheek request by a new player for Ed Sheeran to perform at their wedding. And the club were averaging a new signing every 4.8 days during the window. And one name that was not mentioned amongst all of the other 20 signings was Sonny Aluka, who we actually spoke about in our Aberdeen episode. He scored a very famous goal against Bayern Munich. But the last member, probably the most high-profile member of this new squad, is Ed Sheeran, who's a devoted fan, lives in Suffolk. He's been named an honorary member of the squad and was given the number 17 shirt. And for a while on Ipswich's Wikipedia page, his position was just set to vibes.
He's even taken to sponsoring Ipswich Town shirts with his upcoming tour and album. Ed even stated, with the new owners from the US coming in, there are sure going to be exciting times ahead for Ipswich fans, including myself. You can see regularly on their social media, on his social media and Ipswich Town social media, that he's there supporting the club pretty much week in, week out, unlike most celebrity fans who kind of just turn up for maybe one showpiece game and then you don't see them again for a couple of seasons.
Yeah, and he's involved in the kit launches and things like that. So yeah, he seems pretty hands-on with it all and yeah, very ingrained in the club. I'd be interested to know what Ipswich fans genuinely think. But yeah, however, despite this positive outlook amongst all the change on the club, it didn't quite work out on the pitch and cost Paul Cook his job in the dugout.
One day prior to announcing Paul's replacement, Barrow would win 2-0 in a replay and sent Ipswich crashing out of the FA Cup to add further misery to this situation of having a missing manager and already faced a Carabao Cup exit at home to another fourth tier side, Newport County, and EFL trophy elimination at the hands of Arsenal's under-21 side. So things really weren't going well with this new revitalisation of the American owners.
Terry Butcher was working as a TV pundit as Barrow knocked out his former club. He said, "We're not a big club anymore, we're a small club. Really, when you think about how far we've sunk, you can talk about this and that in the past, but it's not the past that matters, it's the present. And the present at the moment isn't good enough." And to move into this next era to try and sort of pull them out of the doldrums, to replace Paul Cook, the new owners picked up Kieran McKenna after an extensive process. And McKenna had actually, you probably recognise him, been in the background of the Man United bench under Mourinho, Solskjaer, Ralph Rangnick. So he was a coach there and has been picked up by Ipswich. He also brought United's respected first team coach Martin Pert with him, as well as his assistant. McKenna's playing career was actually cut short at youth level due to a hip injury as part of the Tottenham Academy. And after two operations and 2 years of rehabilitation, he decided to take the tough choice and retire at the age of 22.
Spurs offered him a place on the coaching staff of the youth teams, and that's how his coaching career started. In 2016, he was offered the under-18s manager role at Manchester United, and he worked himself up from there to the first team. But the Northern Irishman has his work cut out for him as he takes the reins of his first first team manager's job.
Penner stated, "I strongly believe in the opportunity to build something here." And they would finish the 21-22 season in 11th place. And so when we look to the future of the club, we want to see them building a brighter future. It really feels like one of the sort of sleeping giants, a club of this size, stature and history in the third division. And it feels like, you know, once they can get something together, that momentum would hopefully pick them up, take them to the championship and maybe somewhere beyond. Yeah, so at the time of recording, Kieran McKenna's first full season has got off to a very good start, with 14 points from the first six games of the season, so 4 wins, 2 draws. They're sitting in second place, joint top with Portsmouth, who are just ahead on goal difference. And in and amongst, you know, other big teams are down there, like Sheffield Wednesday, newly relegated Derby. So yeah, things are looking good. Yeah, we're really want to see them carry some momentum and pull themselves back up.
We're hoping after covering Ipswich Town, we get to see them fight for a playoff spot or straight automatic promotion or just winning it outright with this current form anyway. Don't see why not currently. Hopefully they can channel some of that former Alf Ramsey spirit and just climb the tables, back-to-back promotions maybe. Maybe I'm dreaming a bit too loftily for Ipswich Town fans, but hey.
Yeah, it does feel they're on like the cusp of something, like a good young manager who's clearly got a lot of pedigree. Let's see where it takes them this season, and we'll be watching closely. And I hope Ipswich fans, I hope we've done your club justice. Let us know what you think, and of course everybody else, let us know who you want us to cover next time. We're always looking for suggestions. Before we leave, we do have to give a little cryptic hint of where we will be heading next time out.
So our hint is, this team lost to Ipswich Town in the semi-finals of their historic 1980-81 UEFA Cup triumph. We've already mentioned the name, so let us know if you remembered it, or you can figure it out, or maybe just have a little scoop back there on the little slider on Spotify and hear who we'll be travelling to next. But apart from that, I've fully enjoyed. At the beginning of part one, I stated that, to be honest, I didn't know too much about Ipswich Town, but after now, episode five here, part one and part two, I've thoroughly enjoyed reading about the stories of Ipswich Town and Sir Bo Robson and Alf Ramsey. It's been tremendous fun to dive into the history of this club.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it and really looking forward to where the club goes next. And yeah, thanks for listening. And don't forget to give us a rating on Apple Podcasts, share with your friends. Check out our social media pages for giveaways, new episodes, and yeah, thank you once again. It's been a pleasure.
Any Ipswich Town fans with any stories to tell, hit us up on social media. We love hearing them, seeing them, reading them in the comments underneath. This is on YouTube or on Twitter or on Facebook or anything. We love to see them. But apart from that, I think we're done here. It's been episode 5 of the Journeyman Podcast here with Ipswich Town. I'm Joseph Corlett.
I'm Mark Reeves.
We'll see you all guys next time.
See you next time.